On this episode of Mex and Men, Mindo makes a deal. Max reluctantly listens to a few good plans. Akira speaks up, Scott Bradley throws down, and the Highlanders phone home. This is Of Mex and Men, a BattleTech book club. I am Kanan Hill, joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent.
It's I, Brent.
And Aaron.
It's me, Aaron.
How we doing, boys?
I'm not currently being jammed by warhorns, so I'm doing all right.
Well, that's good, because this week we're covering chapters 45 through 48 of the book we've been working through.
Warrior Riposte by Michael A. Stackpole.
Let's get into it.
Chapter 45, Comstar, First Circuit Compound, Hilton Head Island, North America, 15th of November, 3028. So, we're back on Hilton Head. It's a Comstar chapter, and once again, Mindo Waterly is in here, annoying everyone, as usual, right? What's she up to now? Well, she's requesting an interdiction. On who? House Davian, of course, right? Yeah, Mindo's in here. She wants to interdict House Davian. Precentor Tharkad points out that House Davian hasn't really done anything to warrant an interdiction. And not only that, but interdictions go both ways. If Davian can't send any messages through Comstar, then we don't get to read his mail. That's bad for us too, right? Waterly, she wants to interdict. Nobody's buying it. No one's into it. They're not feeling it. However, Waterly is of the opinion that these guys clearly just don't get it, right? Because it's obvious to her that Hans Davian intends to conquer the entire inner sphere, right? He's a maniac. He's going to take everything.
That separates him from the other successor lords, right?
Yeah. We have to stop him. He's on a warpath.
I mean, he is on a warpath. That is true.
I do feel like Comstar is being very chill about this. For the war that was announced at their whole party that they set up, they're like, it's just another war. It's not a big deal.
To your point, it's true. They are, but they also, it's clear that a lot of these people understand logistics and what it takes and believes they know what House Davian, what equipment and what they can afford to accomplish, right? That's kind of what we're, I'm getting a little ahead of the curve, but which is not exactly true. They don't have perfect knowledge of that. On the other hand, Mindo's the other extreme, right? The sky is falling. If Hans Davian isn't stopped, he will rule the entire inner sphere, which is just impossible. Logistic, right? Like, it's just an impossibility. He might get a decent foothold. We're yet to be seen, but there's just no way. That's not how any of this works.
Yeah, the Primus is hitting her with the, like, don't worry, he'll tuck her out soon.
Yeah. That is kind of the energy.
He's not gonna, no one can conquer everything. It's too expensive.
Right? Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mindo does bring up, however, she reminds the Primus about how, remember when he predicted that there would not be any significant changes to the Capellan Fed Sun's border in their lifetimes. And yet, here we have what appears to be a fairly significant change in the Capellan Fed Sun's border.
Significant is relative here.
Yeah.
I would say.
The Fed Sun's have pushed pretty deep into Tychonov space.
It's true. More than I think Julian Tiepolo would have ever thought, obviously based off of what he said. Despite Mindo calling Tiepolo on what she perceived as BS, the other Primuses kind of back Tiepolo up, right? They're kind of like, yeah, he was wrong about that, but not that wrong.
He's only kind of wrong.
Only kind of wrong, which is still wrong. That's Mindo's whole thing here.
Precentor Sian reminds Mindo that if they were to interdict House Davian, then that would cut off the flow of intel from Michael to Max Liao, right? It's funny because Mendo reminds Precentor Sion that Michael's information isn't even that helpful, right? Like, who cares? Right? She's like,
Hans
okay.
barely does.
Yeah, I don't. But then Liao wouldn't get, like, what, the fake troop figures from Michael? He's like, not. It's not insignificant. He's like, not a threat. It's fine. However, an interdiction would absolutely stop intel coming in from Alexei Malenkov. Okay? And that could be significant.
And Comstar knows as best as anyone that that flow of information, the intelligence, the spying, is truly what maintains a lot of the balance, right? That's their point here. I feel like it's not really dug in, but in my mind, that's what they're saying. It's the subtle, like, the spying that we allow to take place, that flow of information back and forth, that's the real cement that prevents borders from changing too much. Our friend here, Mendo, she still remains ignorant.
Our friendo Mendo? Oh, so this is where Precentor New Avalon points out that Davian isn't even really using Comstar to communicate with his forces right now. Fact, now it seems like Operation Galahad was, at least in part, an exercise in military communication strategies without the use of HPGs, right? So,
absolutely.
Not only does he not need us, he's also been practicing.
In my opinion, this should be the thing that the Comstar Precentors should be more concerned about, in my opinion.
I thought the same thing.
We call this a red flag.
Right. Yeah. Right. This is, if ever, anyone should be yelling about anything in this room, it should be this. And it's smart on Hans's part to try and not even just from a, I suspect Comstar is more than they seem kind of way, not even conspiracies aside, just from a funding standpoint. Comstar's expensive to send messages interstellar. So it makes sense just from that point of view, which they do comment on that. But training to be more effective at not needing them means they're going to have less information. And it's like their whole thing.
Yeah. And it should also be a big red flag that Hans isn't sending the information to them. And that sounds like it's being done intentionally.
That's right. Yeah. That's a very good point.
The fox, dude.
But as we see, Comstar, as it sits right now, and this is something that I think the book's been hitting at, is that they're kind of out of touch, right? And like the old heads are out of touch. And then Mendo, who's kind of relatively younger, is coming in, and she's on the extreme end, and she's kind of doing this overreaction, right, to try and fix what she perceives as broken. As we're going to see here, neither's really the right answer, but I digress.
Yeah. Also, Mendo still has yet to provide a good reason why House Davian deserves to be interdicted in the first place.
That's right.
Right? No one's buying it. Yeah. We need a good reason, but why, Mendo? Okay. How about this one? Davian is on his way to conquering the Tikhonov commonality. And as we know, Tikhonov is a powerful industrial base, an economic powerhouse, right? Tikhonov. And if he's allowed to do this, he will become too strong and too rich and too powerful, right? And he's not working alone either, because he tricked the Lyran Commonwealth into attacking the Draconis Combine for him.
Tricked is a strong word. There's a lot of moving parts for it to be a trick.
Yeah, it's the big trick of merging their houses politically and then having them do the same action at the same time.
And marriage and an alleged romance. It does appear that through Stackpole's writing, we see that it is political, but it's also, it's a little more than just politics. So yeah, tricked, I don't think, is quite the correct word. Operation Gatterdammerung was, in every way, kind of a joint idea.
Gatterdammerung?
It is a mouthful.
Yeah. Or like, this is where Precentor New Avalon brings up that he just thinks that maybe Mendo is just mad that the Combine got attacked. You know what I mean? Maybe it's some kind of, you know, maybe she's just mad about it.
This is also my theory, if I'm going to be honest, because this has kind of been, if we look at the way Mendo has been acting the whole time, it has been with a sort of nationalism that Comstar is supposed to abstain from.
Yeah, and her counter argument is nah.
That's most of her arguments, really.
Yeah. That, that ain't it, Chief. That's not it, right? Right, because you know, Davian's success isn't just bad for the Combine; it's bad for everyone, right? It affects all of us. Oh, I like this is where Primus Tiepolo himself jumps in to remind Mendo that the word of Blake actually accounts for inter-house warfare. If she didn't know, we're not surprised by this. Basically, literally prophesized. Actually, right? In fact, it is through petty conflict like this that Blake's will eventually come to fruition, as foretold. Am I right?
Of course, she hits back with kind of a do not cite the deep magic to me, witch kind of energy.
Now, Mendo does think that this is different, though. She thinks that this isn't what Blake meant, because Blake was talking about a fracture. But this is more of like a unification, right? It's different. It hits different. Huh? Am I right?
Right. Oh, I mean, yeah, but also, well, we're all students of history in Battletech to some degree.
Yeah, all the modern eras are like free of war and stuff, right? Like they're all, we're all one big happy family in Battletech from this point on.
The presenters, I think they understand why she's worried, but also I think they've seen a thing or two.
Yeah, she's tripping. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're all just very tired of Mendo. At this point, like every time she says something, they're like, nah, it's like, Mendo, come on now.
If we look at the things through the lens of Comstar, the answer really isn't do nothing, but it's also not overreact. Again, the answer is somewhere in the middle. But the problem is these quote unquote sides in Comstar, this dialogue would be positive if it was actually seeking out to try and find a common solution, but it's kind of just the old head shrugging and Mendo continuing to be angry.
Precentor Sion thinks that perhaps it is the ferocity and aggression and efficacy of Davian's attack on the Capellan Confederation that has Precentor Dieron a little shook, right? It is quite shocking. He's been so successful, but there's no way he can keep it up, right? He doesn't have the supplies. It's too expensive. His logistics chain isn't strong enough to support continued conquest. It's got to slow down. It has to. At some point, not only that, but House Liao is definitely going to pick up on this. Liao's got that crisis team, right? Right? They're going to get to the bottom of this.
I mean, the Capellans have one thing working for them right now, and its name's Justin Allard.
Yes. That man's picked up a lot of slack.
It's really all of it. He's holding the whole damn chain. But it's true. Liao can't crumble forever, right? I guess I get what they're saying.
Yeah. I noticed a lack of mention of Romano in his argument here.
Yeah, or any of the dissent in the Capellan house.
He's like, that's Solaris champions, got it.
The crisis team will come through for us, you see. Because they're going to realize that Davian's supply chain is the weak link, and they're going to exploit it, right? Listen, we understand that Precentor Dieron is very concerned, but, you know, maybe she's just overreacting a little bit, right? Also, it's worth noting that pretty much all of the units that Davian is using as part of the invading force are Crucis March units, okay? No Capellan March units are contributing to the war effort currently. So he's not using any of Michael's guys. And if Hans overcommits too many Crucis March units, then that would leave him open to an attack by Michael, which Hans is not going to do.
Which, now that this is brought up, doesn't that feel like maybe this is somewhat what it's all about anyway?
Yeah.
If you start thinking about it here, right, like if you have someone you know is operating against you, if the fox truly is the fox, doesn't it make sense that maybe he'd go to great lengths to try and root out the problems in his house, especially when we see how he works just with, like, his boys, right? He clearly understands the concept of every unified goal, right? And he knows someone in his house is causing problems.
Yeah, he's trying. That's the whole thing. That's, I mean, you know, Michael's slippery, though, right?
We've even learned, right, that Hans understands, you know, I want to make certain things look vulnerable, right? He maybe wants the Crucis March, maybe New Avalon to look a little too juicy, and maybe he can finally get rid of, you know, I don't know, just a crazy tinfoil hat theory here.
As I was reading this and kind of going through this, some of the, I guess, future planning and predicting of this, you're like, is this even about Capellan space? Or is this about solidifying power in Davion space?
Cleaning house.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised that the Comstar here isn't talking about it.
Yeah.
Because they lay everything out.
Now, the Primus believes that Michael will strike eventually, but he's going to let Hans and Liao weaken each other. And then he will wait until an opportune moment to strike. Of course, when this happens, Morgan will naturally oppose his father, which will then split the Capellan March and further weaken the Federated Sons. You know, I guess. I don't know.
That sounds like a prediction that hinges upon the fact that Hans wouldn't be ready for an attack from Michael.
Yeah.
That's true. And it is unusual here that that Comstar is underestimating the Fox.
Well, if we were playing devil's advocate with it, Hans seems to have gone at great lengths with Quintus to keep all of this off the books intentionally.
That's a very good point, Aaron.
Primus also mentions the Combine because Theodore Corita is gaining power and he's really cool.
And don't hold back, Kanan. Yeah.
And his dad is really mad about it, right? So,
how cool he is or the power?
Find out in the future. Yeah. Theodore Corita, he's a cool dude. And this will almost certainly cause internal division within the Combine. Also, a weakening of the Dracona state could prompt Russell Haig to seek independence.
Yes. And we've talked a little bit about Russell Haig before. I think on Verdandi in Mercenary Star, there's kind of this corridor in between the Lyran Commonwealth and the Draconis Combine. In between isn't quite the right word because it's made up of a section of both sides that kind of all have this similar heritage. And, well, we'll see more on that in the future.
And don't forget, this cascading series of events could then prompt Duke Lestrade to seek independence for the Isle of Skye. At least this is what the Primus, he just goes off about all this. He's like, I don't know, maybe. I'm like, sure. This is, I mean, okay. Could prompt Russell Haig to seek, you know, independence. I mean,
we'll have to see.
Now, listen. Precentor Sion hypothesizes that Davion should run low on supplies probably around the beginning of the year, and he'll have to slow his conquest down. All of his resources are going to have to go into protecting what he's taken, right? So he'll definitely have to slow way down in terms of taking new worlds.
That's right. Right? Like, just because you take these new worlds, you get rid of the garrisons that are there. Well, if you don't keep dudes there to prevent a counterattack, well, they're just going to take it back, turns out. And so this is kind of what I was getting at earlier, right? The percentors understand that they're going to have to work within the confines of the resources that they currently possess. And that's only going to get them so far.
Precentor Sion also brings up that Colonel Ridzik could potentially declare independence for Tychonoff as well. And he suggests that if he does, we should totally help him out. Am I right?
Remember, that's the individual sleeping with Max Liao's wife.
Yeah, Lady Elizabeth.
Well, that won't be any trouble.
Precentor New Avalon agrees. All that sounds pretty good. Independent Tychonoff would be sweet. That'd be tight. But yeah, Davian's got a couple of waves left in him, but he's going to slow down. It's fine. Ryan, what are you worrying about?
Go have a pint and let's wait for this whole thing to blow over at the Winchester.
Now, Waterly, still unsatisfied, demands to know at what point will they consider interdiction to be a valid option.
Again, what has Hans Davion done to warrant an interdiction?
Well, Precentor New Avalon suggests that if Davion takes Sarna, then perhaps we could seriously consider it. Okay? The world of Sarna. Now, Mendo finds this a little irritating because it is a bit of a stretch, right? Okay, so Sarna is pretty deep in Capellan territory. So chances are, Davian forces are not going to reach Sarna. It's unrealistic, right? But we'll see. And Mendo, she's not happy about it, but she is happy that they've finally given her something to work with, right? So she amends her motion and requests that if House Davian takes Sarna, First Circuit will levy an interdiction. And the council agrees, right? They're chill with it. That's it.
This seems to satiate her for now.
Yeah. The chapter ends with Waterly thinking about how all she has to do now is get Davian to attack Sarna.
And this isn't a Stackpoleism, a setup for something to come up in the text later or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll never see this ever again. Also, isn't Sarna, isn't that the name of the wiki?
Yeah.
I was excited when I got to see that I was like, oh,
Sarna. Yay.
Shout outs to Sarna.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, dude. Sarna is the backbone of the community, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. And here it is. But yeah, what do you think, boys? Blake's will be done. Am I right? The Comstar chapter.
It ends with Mendo kind of like rubbing her hands together, thinking how smart she is.
Yeah.
Listen, if you're ever doing any planning, and you're contemplating how smart you are about your plans, probably in trouble. Okay, if literature has taught me anything, okay, you're probably not as smart as you think you are. And it is very irritating. I find Mendo a very unlikable character, obviously intentionally, in that she's so sound and how with just these simple wizards like keeping me from my plans, I will undoubtedly get what I want. I don't like her.
Well, neither does Comstar. No, I mean, all these chapters kind of end that way. A Mendo chapter ends with her going like, just you wait.
All just according to wait. Plan, even though she barely got anything that she wanted. They gave her a freebie, but clearly she intends to exploit the conditions of this arrangement that Comstar has made.
I have come to love these Comstar check-in chapters, though. It's just, you get the feeling of like all the downplaying and overhyping that we get from both sides. We get the overly calm and the overly aggressive Mendo with everything else that you're like, oh, Stackpole is going to have something big come from this. Like the pacings in these books, and whenever we have this like repeated check-in scene, it always builds up to something big.
Yeah. Yeah, he was feeling it.
And I was glad we got one of these here post-wedding, because if you remember when we were talking about the wedding scenes, when we got to the conclusion of it and we mentioned the idea of like Comstar was acting really shady the whole time, and it kind of feels like it was meant to throw you off, but the fact we had all that, and then pair it with another check-in here, you're like, something's going on with Comstar.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see what it is.
What's going on with Comstar?
Right now, a lot of arguing.
It is clear there is some big looming plot to come from them in the future, right? Like, that we can be certain of.
You never, like, learn anything. It's always just them, like, catching up.
Yep.
Right?
Which I think is a really important part of those is that we talked about it during the whole wedding arc, that Comstar was always playing this reactive game. And so each time we go to one of these chapters and it's like, here's what's going on. Is it a big deal? Not really. We got a plan for it. It's all good. Except there never really is a plan that they're talking about or anything like that.
This kind of complacency can only come from years of simplistic patterning, right? So what I mean by that is, that what they've been dealing with from the successor lords previous to this was things that were completely predictable by them. It's the only way that an organization designed to kind of monitor and manipulate the entirety of the machinations of mankind could possibly get to this level of complacency. I'm serious, though. Like, and I think that this is kind of the whole thing here, is that Hans, however you feel about Hans Davion, and I know that the community as a whole is very divided on the subject of Hans Davion, even myself.
I would say even here, between the three of us, we have divisions in the way we see him.
Totally. But say what you will, the man is clearly shaking things up in the way that he does things.
No, I agree. And that in these books is the thing to stand out about it, is that he is coming at this in a different way than we've seen all the other leaders react to something. He's definitely going outside the playbook here to handle all of this, which makes it very interesting. And I think that I've really enjoyed the consistency throughout all of this to make that land, to really have Hans stand out one way or the other as an impactful character compared to the other rulers in the successor states from what we've seen of them so far.
Hans Davion, can't live with him. Can't live with him.
These books do. I mean, he's not the good guy.
Yeah.
This is Hans's crusade. I mean, this whole thing, the whole fourth succession war, this is his thing.
He is really good at optics. He does often take the moral high ground, and he also makes sure everyone knows, right? When he doesn't take the moral high ground,
he makes sure nobody knows.
Exactly. And I think really that's a kind of a cornerstone of his success.
Marketing.
He's got good branding.
So they agree to do an interdiction, but only if Davion attacks Sarna. Is he going to do it? What's going to happen? Will Mindo manipulate from the shadows? Who can say? It's Comstar.
And with that, we got to see how Comstar feels about the war. But we'll have to cut over to the Crisis team, see how they're holding on in the next chapter.
Chapter 46. It is the 21st of December. We have returned to Sion, and we're back with Justin and Sen Shong. We get another Justin chapter, the Crisis team. They're standing around their little hollow table. They look terrible, by the way, right? They haven't been sleeping well. It's been a tough few months, you know, since the war and all that, right? The war that, by all metrics, it looks like they're losing, right?
Yes, it does.
Right. We can see by the hollow map that the war is not going very well. Okay? They're looking at, you know, they have this cool holographic map. They have the star map and everything has colors on it. You can see that, like, the Davion forces have nearly completed, like, cutting off Tychonoff. Right? They're killing it. This is what Quintus was telling Hans. We're killing it. Our two favorite Maskrovka agents, however, they have noticed a glaring weakness in the Davion offensive, the logistics chain.
Oh, yeah.
And they hypothesize that if they attack the supply bases, they can stall the Davion war effort. What do you think?
Yeah, it's just like Hans was telling us about. That weakness he didn't want to completely bury and leave out in the open.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like they're on the hook.
Now, unfortunately, the Chancellor won't listen to them. Okay? He's delusional. Max Liao wouldn't go for it, and Sen Shong is unable to convince Romano. He's like, I can't even talk to her. She's so mad about the Highlanders, because the first Kearney Highlanders took off from High Spire. She's been in a nasty frame of mind. You see, I highlighted there. I highlighted nasty. And she should have known the first Kearney would head out as soon as they got the news about the second Kearney getting hit on Jonathan. All the Highlander regiments feel a kinship with each other. She's mad. Her favorite Highlanders... It's like when your favorite football team leaves. Right? She's in a bad mood, man. Did you guys hear, dude? The Highlanders left High Spire. They're called the Texans now.
She's mad because they're leaving, and so they're under contract to the Capellans. However, they're not being ordered somewhere else. The first Kearney got hit real bad, and now they're all going to the rescue.
Yeah. Well, the second Kearney needed help, so the first Kearney abandoned their post, is what it appeared to be, and then Romano is upset about that. It's just a little paragraph here. Something that Sen kind of mentions. I was like, oh, that's funny.
Right, but when someone's in your ploy, you expect them to kind of go where you order them. And it is, and listen, I'm a fan of the Northern Highlanders. It is a little unprofessional, right, for the second Kearney to get injured, and then they just all, like, run off to support them instead of...
This is where Justin slumps onto the floor, and he asks Sen about the data they're getting from Michael. How's the latest data from Michael looking? I mean, I think he says, you know, the data's reasonable, right? It checks out. But Sen is still hesitant to trust Michael. I mean, we've already established they know he's cooking the books, right? He's not fooling them, but he's still playing along, right? Keeping up his end of the bargain.
Yeah, that's been my favorite part of this whole Michael arc, is that both sides that he thinks he's fooling are like, oh, Michael's just giving weird numbers to Liao. And the Capellans are like, oh, he's giving us bad numbers.
Yes, they're like accounting for a margin of dishonesty in their own numbers, right? Just because they know, because it's Michael.
Yeah.
And now, if the Davian forces maintain their current pace, the next wave should hit, I think, around February, they say. But that means that his storehouses are getting more swole by the day, right? He's stocking up. They're stacking boxes, right? The storehouses, because they're not living off the land, right? They're having to truck all this stuff in. So it's expensive. Invading an interstellar nation, they're like, they really want to hit the storehouses, and the Chancellor won't let them. However, this is where Max Liao like barges in, and he's like holding a DVD and yelling, right? He comes in, he's like yelling at him, you know, put it in. He puts it, I think he feeds it into like the holo table. He has a disc. I remember, what does it say? Oh, a spear of light fragmented into rainbow shards reflected from a holo disc. I was like, dude, it's a CD, right? it's got the CD rainbow effect. Yeah, he's got a disc, okay?
I like to think that because it's the future, it's kind of like, it's like the cassette CDs. You know what I mean? It's that retro.
No,
not the laser disc. It's almost like it's a floppy disc with a CD in it, right? It's like a translucent. It's like the future.
Oh, this is a timeline where the Sony UMD.
Yeah.
Like, right?
Like the UMD.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do love how ever since the wedding, anytime we hear about Max or see him, he's just completely unhinged at this point. Like, he's just running around yelling all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, it makes sense that he is, but I still find it very funny.
Yeah, dude. He's unhinged. He's got the whole mad ruler thing going on. All right. So what's going on here? The Chancellor has received a message from Pavel Rydzik. And so they put the disc in, and a little hologram of Rydzik pops up. Remember, this is the guy from Tikhonov, right? And he's also kind of like the military leader. He's, you know, he's like his top general.
And he's sleeping with Max's wife.
Right. At the wedding. Remember, you know, we've
Bungalow tech.
He's got a message from Pavel, dude. I do like, though, you know, the little hologram pops up, right? And Pavel starts like delivering his message. Justin thinks, though, he's like, man, this guy's cool, right? There's like this bit here where Justin's like, man, this guy's like so much cooler than Max Liao. There's like some admiration. So, message from Rydzik. Colonel Rydzik beseeches the Chancellor to listen to his plea, okay? Because Tikhonov has fallen and the people are losing hope. He is calling to propose a solution, right? Things aren't going well, but I have an idea. Basically, Rydzik requests that the Chancellor approve a series of troop movements and allow him the use of the command circuit, right?
It's a big ask in the middle of a war.
Yes, he says, I require that my own unit, Stapleton's Iron Hand, all three battalions be transported up to within striking range of Tikhonov, right? So he's got some units elsewhere. They're stationed. He's trying to get all these units. He's calling for, like, some pretty dramatic reinforcements. And he warns Liao that without his assistance, Tikhonov will be lost, right? If you don't help me, it's not going to make it. Now, Rydzik has included a star map detailing the requested troop movements. We get a look at it, okay? Justin thinks it could work. It could work, all right? But it's risky business. And he admires Rydzik's tenacity, right?
I think Justin's just happy that somebody else is out here trying to win this war.
Yeah, he's like, man. You know, we love to see some initiative.
That's two sane plans today.
Yeah, good hustle.
It's like it's a compelling record.
Now, Chancellor Liao asked them, is this good? Does this check out? What do you guys think? And the boys explain that it could work on paper, okay? But Rydzik's intel contradicts Michael's intel. Not everything matches up with our records, so we're not sure. But also, and crucially, the whole operation would be a logistical like nightmare. Right.
What he's asking for
is actually quite difficult. Yeah. Basically impossible is what I think Justin thinks. He's like, we kind of just can't. The price would be too steep. And yeah, and they're, you know, they're using all those jump ships and that command circuit, right? The one that they set up for Duke Michael, yeah.
Right. That command circuit is having that tied up doing something. That's having a command circuit in the first place is such a valuable resource. And tying it up over
Over Michael. Yeah, exactly. It's like, it isn't even worth it, right? Who cares? It's not even good. I mean, come on. Somebody shoot this man. Am I right?
Oh, now, man, here comes the assassinations.
Yeah. Now we're thinking like Capellans.
Yeah. Oh, this is where Chancellor Liao, he's thinking about it, right? He has this like revelation, okay? I mean, so he thinks that Rydzik is up to something, okay? That there might be some hidden motivations.
It's funny you should say that, Max. Before we get into the details, though, can we talk about how Max Liao spit inside? That's gross.
It's where Michael learned it from.
At least he spit into the trash. Well, tried to.
I like, this is where Shang, he's like, this is my moment.
While you're here.
Yeah, he takes another shot at pitching the Chancellor on the whole supply base operation, right?
Right.
He's like, oh, this plan's all right, but you know what's a good plan? We've been cooking a little something.
A crisis team special.
Yeah, right. Shang explains the situation with the supply depots. I like, at one point, the Chancellor becomes visibly enraged, and Justin has to calm him down before Shang can continue. It's just so funny, and Shang's trying to explain it, and that Max gets so mad. I think that he just can't, Shang says something he doesn't understand immediately. Justin has to be like, it's okay. She's like, right? He's like,
that's a sign of a sane and competent leader.
Yeah, he gets him calmed down though, right? Yeah.
You know it's going good when you got to put your hand on his chest. Be like, oh, well, hold on. He's just talking.
Then we get this bit where, okay, I love this part. Shang keeps talking and Justin pulls up a notebook and starts to write down. He starts to take meticulous notes. Okay, and the Chancellor, like, glances down at him and gives him, like, an affirming nod. And then Shang, like, stops for a moment and looks at Justin and nods, and he even slows down his speaking to make sure that Justin can keep up writing. It's like a very, like, Capellan moment. It's like, hold on, someone should take notes. And then they all, like, nod, like, mm-hmm, and, like, flip the, and then it's like, mm-hmm, like, I will stop, and you will write. And then they're just, like, taking notes on, like, this. It's just, like, funny. There's just, they just stop. There. It's a, I was like, oh, a Capellan moment. Right. Shang continues. He explains that they want to hit Davian storehouses on Halloran 5, Kawich, New Aragon, and Nopa, and I think two others. The Chancellor asks Justin, what do you think? And Justin agrees that it's a good plan, but he's still hung up about Axton, right?
He wants to Axton him a question.
Axton, dude, right? He explains that during the course of his investigation, he uncovered financial data that could indicate a potential black site, all right? Justin believes he may have finally found the secret NAIS facility that he's been looking for, and he wants permission to dispatch the 4th Tau Ceti Rangers to investigate, okay? Oh, Justin remembers that Candace had Axton as one of her plates at the wedding. Remember their dessert plates with the worlds on them? Axton was one of them. He mentioned that back at the wedding. Yeah, he thinks it's on Axton. He wants to assault Axton. it's Justin's grail. That's what Shin says. When the Chancellor's like, what are you talking about? Shin's like, oh, that's Justin's grail. He's been insane about this secret facility, right? This is like a plot thing. He buys it, though. Chancellor Liao is convinced that their idea is better than Ridzik's, and he gives them permission to proceed. That's cool.
You know, Justin had to have a huge sigh of relief at that moment of just like, yes, finally, a plan.
Yes.
Also, there probably was a moment there where he was like, man, I hope Max Liao doesn't just shoot Shen Sheng.
Yeah. This is where Sheng points out that if they could cooperate with the Draconis Combine, that would relieve pressure on the task force, right?
Amazing.
You know, slash down into the Terran corridor, I think.
Are we going to have three competent ideas back to back?
We're going for broke today.
Yeah. Because the Galadon district, as we know, is tied up in the war with the Wolf's Dragoons.
The war on the Wolf's Dragoons.
The Steinerborner is stabilized. If the Combine could kind of push down into the Terran corridor, that would force them to reinforce. It would, you know, take some pressure off of us.
Yeah. It would spread the assets in the Capellan March out.
Yeah. It's also a good idea. As you said, the Chancellor agrees to contact Takashi Kurita immediately, right? All right, I'll call him. That sounds great.
Amazing.
So,
man, I'd love to see that phone call.
Yeah.
You got one man who's just like...
Takashi!
Who's going a million miles per hour, and the other one who's pretty much at a standstill.
Max Liao's borderline if cocaine was a person, and Takashi Kurita is a very disciplined but angry man. It's an interesting pairing.
Oh, this is where Chancellor Liao appears struck by a sudden revelation, right? He starts like rambling all of a sudden. He's like, ah, sah, yes, I understand. I know. Ah, it's clear. Clear as crystal. He's I don't know. He starts going crazy. He's going off. He orders Operation Riposte to proceed immediately.
They did the thing.
All right. I clapped when I saw it. Yeah. Including the assault on Axton. Yes, throw Justin's thing on there too. Yeah, so they're given the complete green light, but only with the addendum that they must also eliminate the most dangerous threat to the Capellan Confederation, which, I mean,
Max
I
Liao?
Thought was Max Liao. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a toss-up between Max and Romano at this
point. That's true. Yeah, I would actually, you know what?
You have to shoot me.
Romano, in my opinions, is the higher echelon target.
Yeah. I mean, she's got like the raccoon police or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, Justin and Sen, who were following along at first, now look confused. And the Chancellor continues rambling.
As he does.
Eventually, it becomes clear that the Chancellor has come to believe that Pavel Ridzik actually means to betray him. That this is a setup for a double cross.
Interesting.
And that he would have taken the reinforcements and used them to declare Tychonoff independent, eventually allying himself with House Davian. So basically, Chancellor Liao orders the death of Colonel Ridzik.
There it is.
For the crime of hypothetical future treason.
Listen, you get three good plans in a day. You gotta give a little leeway on an assassination, all right?
It was inevitable. There was too many consecutively sane plans for there not to be an assassination.
I could just imagine the giant red flag that Justin is just watching rise behind Max at this point. As he's like, we're rolling. He's agreeing. We're getting everything done. He's agreeing to everything. So I'm glad we got three good plans. And then right at the end, he's like, by the way, I'm going to distrust the one guy who's on the front line right now, who's running the show of the war for me. And we're going to take him out. And Justin's got to be going, oh, man. Oh, can't we send you on a vacation or something, Max? Can we just get you out of here for a little bit? Leave it to the crisis team. We got it. We'll take over the war.
But that's not even the craziest part.
Comstar thought the same thing, though. Remember?
Yeah.
That he might declare independence, which is what's funny. That's the precentors were saying the same thing. And they were like, dude, if he does, we should totally support him. He's cool. the thing is, everyone thinks he's cool.
Well, the barometer for sane Capellans is...
Like, the problem is he's, like, kind of a Chad, it seems like. You know, Liao's a hater, basically.
But the craziest thing in all this is he's right.
He's right, yeah.
Which is probably the most messed up thing, because it doesn't feel like it's competence.
No, the insane rambling doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in where the idea originated from.
But it's a broken clock is correct twice a day.
Also, he's being put to death for being in the position to commit treason. He didn't actually commit the treason. It's just it's like hypothetical future treason.
Yeah. Which, if you're working for this man, it's a bit of a red flag.
Yes. Well, and if we take that point and compare it to what we've seen from Hans, where Hans has this situation with Michael, and the whole time he's like, how can I use this to my advantage? And Max is like, nah, get rid of him. Just get rid of this guy. And like, Justin's like, do you want to think about it? And he's like, absolutely not. Just deal with him.
Again, he is correct, but not because he has any reason to be correct. What a wild ride.
What a wild war.
I just want to, like, for a moment, let's all, like, think about what it's like to be Justin Zheng in this moment, right? You know, you've traveled across the inner sphere. You were excommunicated from your former state. You went to the
Solaris champion.
You went to Solaris and became the champion.
Got the ring. Yeah.
Were kidnapped by your father's greatest adversary. Greatest in quotation marks. And now you're here working for him, and you realize, oh, him and his whole family are insane. It's got to be a weird position, with the exception of, okay, it might have been a bit of a broad stroke, because Candace Liao, so far, seems rather sane.
I think anyone would, if you stacked him in this competition.
That's true. Listen, he's sleeping in his bed that he made, but man, I don't think it's cozy.
So Chancellor Liao wanders out of the scene, cackling to himself. And we get a moment where Justin and Sen can't decide whether he's a genius or he's totally insane.
Yeah.
Because for all they know, right, maybe Ridzik would defect.
Maximilian Liao almost feels like the kind of character that would have his wife have an affair with someone just to get the drop on him. I'm not saying that's what happened, but I'm just saying I feel like it's not off the table with this guy.
He's already betrayed the chancellor in bed, right? Oh, I guess they do hypothesize that maybe he would like betray him so that he could, like, who says the colonel doesn't want a clear claim to the chancellor's wife? Huh? Anyway, back to the office. The boys are preparing themselves for a night of paperwork, right? Long night of paperwork, mostly. They're like, all right, time to get back to the war, which for them means, like, filling out endless forms, right? Various paperwork, reading reports, summarizing, filing things, printers. And this is where Alexei enters the office. Alexei Malenkov. Hey.
Did somebody talk about betrayal?
Yeah. So Justin asks Alexei, what's he doing skulking about so late? Alexei admits that this job has made him practically nocturnal at this point, right? Like, I don't sleep at night. So Alexei asks Justin if he needs help with anything. Okay, so Justin tells Alexei to transcribe his notes for him, right? Because, Justin laments that he can't type very well since he lost his hand, right? He's just pecking, you know, it's so slow, like, you know, tapping like boomer style, right? He's like, dude, it's killing me. Can help. He tells Alexei to destroy the notes afterwards, as usual. Now, I do like this part where Justin, at this point, must realize that he doesn't have a sick code word for the assassination orders. And he appears to make up Judas Retribution on the spot. And I was like, oh, do you think he had that one in his back pocket? Do you think he's been holding on to that one?
It is straight Justin Core. Like, this is like back on Solaris Justin.
Yeah. Yeah. Judas Retribution. And he's like, oh, okay. You know, what, yeah, sounds nasty. He's like, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did love that. That sounds nasty.
Yeah. Justin requests a readout on all the Maskrovka termination technicians that they have on Tychonoff, preferably an attractive female, right?
Now, termination technicians, yeah, I think's much cooler than Judas Retribution. MPTs. I'm down for
TT
for the termination technicians.
Cleaners, right? I need a cleaner.
Tychonoff termination technicians or triple T.
Now, that's it, right? The chapter ends with Justin, like, leaning back in his chair and just kind of thinking to himself, I like the last line here. Operation Riposte and the death of a traitor. How fitting that thus ends the year of the rat. And this is, the final chapter of 3028, right? We did it. Great year.
It's been a busy year.
Busy year, right? 3028.
We had a wedding. We had a Hell Memory Core happen.
The Memory Core, yeah. The Price of Glory.
Morgan Kell came out of reclusion.
Yeah. Heck of a year.
Yeah.
It was a good one.
One for the history books. But it's good to see everything's going well in the Capellan front for this war. Ships on course. Things are going smooth.
Yeah.
Nobody's completely unhinged.
Yeah, totally. Justin is drowning. Barely just treading water at this point. Making a desperate last ditch. Who knows, you know? They're going to hit these storehouses, man. Operation Riposte.
Triage is really what it feels like.
Triage. Yeah.
Yeah, and to think Justin wants to exact revenge on Hans so bad. And his opportunity was handed to him, like, on a platter by Hans.
A literal platter. Multiple.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And this is the team he's got behind him. It must be, right now, incredibly frustrating and disappointing.
It doesn't mean he can plan, though. We're going to get that secret facility, right? And he's been on that since the beginning.
It's true.
We're going to make these counterattacks. We're going to destroy the storehouses and assassinate Pavel Rydzik. You know, we're going to retake Tikhonov, and it's going to be great.
We'll meet back at the Winchester for a pint.
Right. We're going to laugh about this, and we're going to be like, wow, what were we even worried about, you know? I'm not worried at all. We're doing the loop again. We had our Comstar chapter. We have our Capellan chapter, okay? This rotation's getting kind of wild. We're going around. I like this rotation we got going. We're like, all right, where are we going next?
Yeah, now that we've seen how the war on the Capellan border is going, we'll have to check in on how things are going up a little further north in the next chapter.
Chapter 47. We're on Northwind. It's the 11th of January, and Akira Brahi is in an Orion. Okay. And he is in a battle with the Phoenix Hawk. That's how we open. We got Akira in the Orion, dude. This is cool.
He's got great taste.
Yeah. So the Genyosha are here on Northwind. I mean, when the chapter opens, we see they're currently engaged with the Blue Blazer Battalion of Team Banzai. Okay. So they're like fighting mechs from Team Banzai. Remember Team Banzai? Remember like Dr. Banzai?
The developers of the Hatchet Man?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Dropping the new tracks for the fourth succession war here?
Yeah, they did the Hatchet Man.
They created some of the first new mechs that we've seen in a long, long time.
Right. And they're also a mercenary company. So we got the Blue Blazer Battalion. They're from Team Banzai. Despite a valiant effort, they have been completely crushed by the Genyosha, right? They roll them up. That's the thing about this scene. It's these dudes getting wrecked. Team Banzai is in retreat. Okay. I do like, there is a bit where Akira is kind of taken aback. The mercenaries are fighting with more heart than he expected, I guess. You know what I mean? They're kind of like really defending their homes or defending their comrades. He's like, these mercenaries fight with honor. This is like a common thing with these Combine guys.
Well, some of them, as we find out.
Yeah. 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 Some of them. So at this point, what's left of the mercenary force has retreated into the mountains, and Kira orders his team back to the firebase, right? They do not pursue. Now, I do like, there's a guy here he's talking to, Chewy Jack Seaborg, good name, and they must be good friends because Akira responds, "Hi, Seaborg-kun," and I thought that was cool. We get a Seaborg-kun, so this is like his boy.
Will you give us a little cultural insight there?
Oh, with the suffix? Yeah, that's like an expression of familiarity, right? I just know that kun would be, they're friends, and his name's Seaborg, so he calls him Seaborg-kun. And I thought that was funny.
So they're buds.
It's Seaborg. It's Jack Seaborg.
Oh, hi, Seaborg.
So, right. And so what is it? This is where on the way back to base, Akira witnesses a DCMS soldier assaulting the captured Phoenix Hawk pilot, right? Because Akira, he's fighting the Phoenix Hawk. The pilot ejects. He's going back to base and they've pulled the pilot out. But yeah, the guard's like beating him up. They're not treating him with honor, right? Akira gets mad about it. He calls the dude out.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's like a little guy on the ground, right? But Akira's like in the mech, like on the loudspeakers. And the dude's pointing up at him like, "Who are you to question me?" I like when Akira tells him that the dragon's blood runs in his veins, right? Because technically I was like, oh yeah, good point.
Also like, hey, he looks down at him and he's like, "We can settle this now if you'd like."
Yeah.
Like the way things stand, me mech'd, you on foot.
Yeah, he's in
the
Orion.
We can duel it out.
That's what's so funny to remember is that I'm like, oh, he's in like a mech. This dude is like tiny down by his feet.
Can we talk about how this dude ejects though? Dude, like, I forgot about this. I read this. I laughed out loud.
Oh, yeah.
This poor guy, he ejects and the pilot, like, he almost gooses, right? Yeah. Like, he, like a part of the chair catches on a part of the mech. And this dude goes, like, comically spinning.
Yeah, he pulls a Dan.
Yeah.
He pulls a Dan. Although this is, like, head over heels, right? Yeah. Like, that's some serious G's. Like, it's impressive that there's even anyone awake to be treated poorly. And this guy isn't just conked out.
Yeah. He clipped that, like, iconic Phoenix Hawk plane, right? And he clipped it. That's the danger of having that sick faceplate.
That's where Dr. Bonsai was like, "I was right the whole time."
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the full head ejections.
I do love how in this scene, to me, was very reminiscent of our introduction to Tara Kito with Yorinaga and the ISF agent. And I thought that was a real subtle play by Stackpole here to say, like, this is Yorinaga's son. He is more emotional. He's more direct and I would say humanized than Yorinaga here through the actions. You get a nice little compare and contrast between how they handle the same situation.
We're going to come back to this in a little bit. I have something to say about a coming up conversation that's very much in the same spirit.
So Akira tells that dude that he's trash. And then Narimasa Asano contacts Akira. Remember Asano? He tells him that Tai Sakurita requests his presence. We gotta go see the boss. Oh, I did notice that Akira assigns an escort to the captured mech warrior before returning to the base.
Just to ensure he doesn't take it out on...
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, hey, go with that guy.
Yeah. I think they call that in the business leadership.
Yeah, Akira's cool. So, they go back to the encampment. Akira arrives at General Conti's headquarters. It says he's got a dark blue silken robe. It's sick. It looks cool. Akira straightened the knot on the sash, holding his robe closed. Heck yeah. So he's got a sweet robe. And Yorinaga is in here, along with Asano. Saladin Bey, remember, he was the leader of one of the other companies, right?
Yes. Yeah. The ones that were like far out in front of the other companies during the training.
And Tarakito Nero. And they're standing across from Hassan Fahd. This is the Fifth Sword of Light's top ISF officer, okay? Taisho Conti, the general, seated at his desk. He's here as well. So we get this cool Genyosha officer meeting scene going on. But we got this ISF guy from the Sword of Light, okay? Kira thinks that Fowl, he's beginning to show the paunch associated with easy living. He's sizing him up and he's like, yeah, this guy's soft. So what are we doing here? Well, the general tells Akira that he has been brought here because of a dispute between the Genyosha and the ISF. Okay? It seems that the Ginyosha have been ordered to kill all the captured mercenaries, right? They've been told to kill, all of the prisoners.
House Karita's kind of going through a little bit of a thing right now with mercenaries. Yeah. They're a little upset.
Yeah, we've gotten the vibes of that so far.
A certain famous mercenary company really kind of cemented this idea. More on that in a completely other book we're going to cover shortly. You know, short for us.
Yeah. Upon hearing this, Akira looks over to his father, who, in a glance, kind of gives Akira permission to oppose the orders, right? You catch that? He looks over at Yorinaga. Yorinaga just kind of looks at him. He's like, it's chill.
Yeah, he's like, you take this one.
Yeah, go off, King. And obviously, you know, they're not chill with it. They don't want to kill the mercenaries. Why would anybody want to kill the prisoners? It's ridiculous. So Kira doesn't think the orders apply for reasons. Besides, they're already operating on orders from the coordinator personally, right? You say these orders are from the coordinator, but we're like, the Ginyosha are their own thing, right? We're different.
Yes.
The Ginyosha are different. And not only that, but you guys told us that the Kellhounds were here. That's the only reason we came here, because you said the Kellhounds were here. But there's no way that those guys were the real Kellhounds.
They too kind of flank them here and are like, if you were wrong about that, you can definitely be wrong about this.
I love how he hits him. He's like, you think these guys, the ones we're seeing out there, could possibly be the Kellhounds 3rd Mech Battalion?
Yeah. Yeah.
Poor Team Banzai.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way that those guys were the 3rd Battalion of the Kellhounds, right?
It makes you wonder, too, like, was this intelligence snafu intentional, right? Is the ISF kind of, their rivalry still kind of getting in the way of operation?
I don't know. Apparently, they have reports that the Kellhounds 3rd Battalion is on planet, right? That's what they're, but that ain't them. Can't be.
No signs of them.
So, Vald gets all huffy. He tells Akira that he has no friends in the ISF. And Akira tells Vald that he has no friends in this room.
This is a familiar situation for the Ginyosha and the ISF.
Yeah. All my homies hate the ISF. Am I right?
It's always like we've got, whenever we have the Ginyosha v. ISF scenes here, it is like the Ginyosha being chill about something and then ISF popping off.
I do, just because we're on it, I do like a little bit farther along here, we do get a comment from Akira Brahi where he says, listen, the Ginyosha does its killing in the battlefield. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny given the threat that was just made to the ISF agent and the fact that the last one was dispatched in a training accident with a training sword.
Look, anything's a battlefield if you call it that.
That's kind of the energy. I thought it was funny that he was so steadfast. Like, listen, the Ginyosha does its killing on the battlefield. I'm like, yeah. Kinda.
So, yeah, ISF, they're annoying. This is the reason that the Ginyosha has been exempted from ISF monitoring, specifically by decree of the coordinator, right? Because it's this is the kind of stuff that just, it drains morale, right? Nobody likes them, right? And they just kind of linger, always walking around with like clipboards. So Kira tells Fowd that if the coordinator wanted Yorinaga to do something, then he would have contacted Yorinaga, right? This has to be ISF business. This is from you guys. This has nothing to do with us. Because, well, one, the Ginyosha is an honorable unit, and two, there's no honor in murdering captives. So it's not meant for us. We're not doing it.
Smells a bit like maybe it might be a trap. Someone trying to tarnish reputations, maybe.
Yeah. You hate to see it. Now, this is where the Taisho, the general, Taisho Kanti, tells Akira that, unfortunately, the orders to execute all mercenary personnel did come from the coordinator.
He just wanted to see how this whole ISF Ginyosha feud was going to pan out before he said anything.
Yeah. Now, Kira knows this is a bad idea, because obviously this will only force the mercenaries to fight more savagely, right? When you're, you know, backed into a corner, right? Cornered animal. This yep. doesn't, everyone knows this doesn't work. Have you like ever like read a book? You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Like what is this? Yeah.
It's in the Art of War. Always leave your enemy.
Yeah.
You got to leave that pressure release valve. Give him a little Hagira.
Yeah. On one side, Akira's like, hey, that'll just create a wave of a stronger sentiment. Actually just create a more dangerous foe and be worse for us in the long run. And then on the other side, Fowled, he believes that mercenary scum like Wolf's Dragoons must be destroyed at all costs. So that's the counter argument.
Still doesn't explain the river, but we'll get to that later. Yeah.
It still doesn't explain the river. Good point. Also, Fowled is surprised because he assumed that Akira would welcome the chance to get revenge on the Kellhounds, right? I mean, come on, why don't you want to kill these guys? Say they're the Kellhounds. Don't you want your revenge? And, oh, he asked Akira, oh, hasn't anyone told you yet? I guess no one's told you yet. And it's at this point that Akira senses a trap, right? Wait a minute, what's going on? Hold on. He realizes that he missed something. And the chapter ends with Fowled delivering the news that the Genyosha base on Nishira has been completely destroyed, right? The Kellhounds hit it, right? That's what yep. he says. The Kellhound regiment hit Nishira and the base has been utterly destroyed. And that's it. The Kellhounds destroyed their base, dude.
Yep, as we remember, Morgan said he had a date
yeah.
to the Genyosha homeworld to Dan
yeah.
a few chapters ago.
On the dropship, that's right. That's right. They like assembled their forces. And so now we see that they, while the Genyosha were here fighting Team Banzai or whatever, the Kellhounds were off like destroying their stuff. So heck yeah.
What a terrible way to find out though. They did Akira and yeah. the rest of the Genyosha dirty.
It's kind of mean. Wait,
it's exceptionally mean.
Yeah, yeah, but also it's like, man, the Kellhounds just rolled up and like stomped their stuff, and we're like, yeah, hey, we're out. And I'm like, dang, Morgan.
They were because they were like, damn, no one's home.
Yeah.
I guess we'll just, yeah,
yeah. I guess just like, toss the place, point? Like load your mechs back on, and be like, oh, sorry. But yeah, Genyosha base has been destroyed. But also a big part of this chapter is obviously about this whole death to the mercenaries situation, right? The coordinator has ordered the execution of all mercenaries, apparently. You gotta kill them. The coordinator said so. And obviously...
he's taking this Wolf Dragoons thing real hard.
Yeah, but also this has to be happening all over the DCMS. You know
yes,
what I mean?
Yeah. Which... Is kind of a weird thing anyway, because even the Kuritans are going to have family and stuff in Mercenary. There's a lot of like, there's a bit of a Venn diagram going on there, yes. right? Like being in the military and probably knowing like friends and family that live in Mercenary. I think that's kind of the theme of this whole yeah. chapter though, is as we've talked about previously, the thing that, well, the Federated Commonwealth has going for it is everyone's going in the same direction.
Yeah.
Here, even these, well, technically on this world, there's three units working together. They all appear to be at odds with each other.
Yeah.
They're fighting the enemy, but they're also fighting amongst themselves. And it's diminishing in effectiveness. I mean, this is a perfect example. They're wasting all of these resources. The ISF is trying to like, appears to be trying to fool the Genyosha, and they're like gaslighting each other. And there's like this fight about like this war on mercenaries, which has got to complicate just all kinds of social circles that most yeah. of the Draconis Combine Mustard Soldiery is going to fall into.
That's a great point.
It's a mess.
The social implications of the death to mercenaries order. That's so divisive.
Not only is it divisive, it's a bit foolish to believe it's even possible. Yeah. I mean, the reality is that no, it's hard to maintain an army big enough to hold all of these planets. There's a reason there's so many mercenary companies. It's because they're never out of work. because there's always like someone needs a garrison here, or there's pirates here. Like, it's a part of the machinations of the Inner Sphere. And so it's a little crazy to think that it's even possible to run a great house and not use mercenaries.
Especially if you've just started off in a war.
Right.
Like, it seems like the most important time to have mercenaries in the back pocket.
And then you're going to piss them all off so that they all go fight. They're all going to want to work for your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because they hear what you're doing. There's overlap in all these mercenary companies. They all, you know, a lot of them know each other. Like, they're going to hear that their buddy got killed by some cutthroat Caretans, and he's going to convince their CO or battalion, whatever, you know, size force mercenary, they're going to be like, let's go fight the Caretans.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, man, if the coordinator wants to help out Hans Davion, he's really doing a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, the Combine really feels like we're back in the Grey Death trilogy right now.
Yes. And it sucks because you see the Genyosha, and the Genyosha's, you know, I was giving them a hard time, but they're trying to be above reproach. They're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to be honorable. We're going to learn here in the next chapter that not everyone's on the same page of how to even deal with this fight on Northwind.
So, you know, speaking of death to mercenaries, in the May 3151 issue of Merklife, okay, actually there's an article. Okay, this is actually from Shrapnel 12, okay, the death to mercenaries. This is interesting, though. So, in an article from an in-universe publication called Merklife, all right, in the May 3151 issue, it reads that the orders repulsed many Combine unit commanders who saw it as a violation of the Samurai Code of Honor. Okay, it's like, I like this, in the future of Battletech, when they write, looking back on this incident, historians note that there were a lot of refusal, right? Just like we think that, like, refuse, like many units outright, you know, didn't do it, right? Everyone just kind of lied. A lot of them just lied, right? They were like, oh yeah, we're killing the mercenaries. But some, you know, but then it also goes on, but it did eventually change culturally. The average citizen started to kind of like all become like mercenary haters, though, right? It became part of the cultural identity that they all like, get out of here, mercenaries. We don't want you. It was like a whole thing, the death to mercenaries. That's what's going on here, right? So,
right.
It's interesting.
It is. That is interesting. And I wasn't aware of this, but I'd always kind of assumed, right? Yeah. I was always kind of like, yeah. It's just one of those things that it's impossible to get everyone to carry through something like this, given kind of the like social structure, just how common mercenaries are. And it's funny because that anti-mercenary sentiment, even in the public eye, could only last so long because there are events that transpire that I certainly believe made the Caretan people think otherwise as to how to feel about mercenaries. But we won't be talking about that for some time. So, but this is interesting. I want to read this. I was not aware. So this was... this was Death to Mercenaries, Rhetoric versus Reality by Eric Salzman. Just to shout out the author. That's interesting, Kanan.
Yeah, this one's cool.
With the death to mercenaries aside, we'll have to see how far these Caretans will take it in the next chapter.
Chapter 48. We're still on Northwind, same time, same place, different perspective. Because now we're hanging out with Major Scott Bradley and Tommy Lester from Team Banzai. Do you remember this guy, Major Scott Bradley? Do you remember Scott Bradley from The Wedding?
Yeah.
From The Wedding.
Remember, this was the dude that came up and talked to Morgan that was like, hey, just want to know if, you know, he apologized for not returning with the hounds, but, you know, he had his own unit now. He had his own guys to, take care of, right? But he was currently under contract with the Fed Sons. He said, I'm currently under contract.
It was like the most reasonable thing ever.
Yeah. But it also solves our question of why did the DCMS think the Kellhounds were here, especially the 3rd Mech Battalion.
Oh.
What did Morgan tell him? He told him to paint his mechs up and designate themselves the Kellhounds 3rd Mech Battalion. And that's why they were listed as being here. Because they were the Kellhounds 3rd Mech Battalion.
I've never put that together. I feel so silly. I'm sure that our audience is going to laugh at me. I've not picked that up. Obviously, based on what I said previously about how I assumed it was some kind of ISF tomfoolery. So no, it was just a legitimate mistake.
Yep.
Oh man, that's cool.
And technically they're not Kellhounds yet, because they haven't joined the regiment, but they were just finishing their contract.
But you could easily see like some Caretan like listening in on literally that conversation, or like any kind of conversation amongst like this mercenary group on their way here and coming in, and maybe even something getting lost in translation and ending up here. That's cool. I can't believe I've never picked up on that.
So Scott and Tommy, all right, they're posted up on the side of this mountain. Okay. They're up here. It's like snowy, right? I feel like it's all like snowy mountaintops. They're up here with their, they got the binoculars. Scott is injured, right? He's on a crutch. He's like hobbling up on a crutch. Yeah, he's got a broken ankle, right? We see right away he's up here on a crutch.
Yeah, like how they describe that he's like makeshifted a crutch out of the lateral leg support from a mech.
Yeah, it's a hasty crutch. I wonder if they teach that in like mech warrior survival schools. Like, here's some parts you can use for.
Yeah, your seat could be used as a flotation device type stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
So Scott and Tommy are up here, up on this mountain, and they are watching what we can now see is a sizable force of Combine mechs approaching in the distance. All right. This is their mountain base, and it hasn't been assaulted yet. But they can see, like, an army of Combine mechs assembling, in the distance. And there's just, like, a smoke rising from where the defending force was.
This army would be the Genyosha, the 36 Diron regulars, and the 5th Sword of Light.
Yes.
So not a good thing to be looking at right now.
It's a lot of Caretans.
Right. The vibes are forlorn, shall we say, because Bradley's command has been decimated. They were completely unable to stop the Genyosha, and Scott feels personally responsible, obviously, but it's not entirely his fault, right? Tommy consoles Scott and reminds him that actually the 5th Deneb Light Cavalry were the house unit on garrison, but shortly before the attack, half of them got poisoned? ? That's what this says.
Oh boy.
Right? It's like, why were they poisoned? Well,
yeah, last they checked, they weren't in Capellan space.
I'll tell you why. Because if you turn to page 78 in your 4th Succession War Military Atlas, Volume 1, you will see that when the Combine forces landed on Northwind, the AFFS forces fought them to a standstill. And the Combine officers, seeing that this thing was quickly turning into a meat grinder, decided that they might try something a little different.
And by a little different, it's a biological warfare.
A classic.
Yeah. They woke up and chose war crimes.
As one does. Now, it is reported that during the second week, a company of sorters assaulted a water reservoir near the city of Cromarty. After the battle, the Combine mechs all waded into the water, stopping for a moment before walking out, presumably to cool off, right? That's what observers thought at the time. However, it wasn't long after that nearly the entire city and half the 5th Deneb were stricken with a severe form of food poisoning, okay? And by the time they cut the water off, over 5,000 citizens were dead. And, however, Team Banzai and Bradley's Bravos were unaffected because, luckily, they pulled their water from a well. That's what this says. Isn't that interesting?
They got real lucky.
Well, and makes the whole poisoning attempt. They just killed 5,000 people in the end for really no reason.
Isn't this nuts?
It just makes it really awful.
Yeah.
It's just terrible.
This happened off screen. So there's a single line where he mentions that, right? He's like, oh, Tommy's talking to Scott, and he tells him the Deneb unit, they got poisoned. And I'm like, how'd they get poisoned? It turns out there was like this whole operation. So I like this little thing out of this book. It says, now, shortly thereafter, the 36th Deron regulars attacked. And despite the condition of the defenders, the attack failed miserably, and the 36th withdrew in seeming disarray. However, the 5th Deneb, under the inexperienced Major Collins, pursued only to be ambushed by the 5th Sword of Light, and they tore him apart, right? So the 36th pulled him out, and they should not have pursued, right? But they did, and the Sword of Light tore him up, and that's what happened.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the 5th Sword of Light that are suspected of poisoning the water, right? They're the ones that waded in the...
Yes, it was specifically, actually, the Military Atlas says, quote, who is responsible for the atrocity is not known, but all evidence points to the 5th Sword of Light and its commander, General Palmer Conti. So, it seems like General Conti was the one who ordered this.
Mm.
And there you have it. So they poisoned the water, man, and they killed all those people. It's terrible.
Where's the honor in that?
Yeah. Do you think the Genyosha knows?
Judging from the way the Genyosha operates and how they've been kept in the dark about other topics, it seems unlikely to me that they are aware, especially how soon this took place prior to the attack.
So, Bradley's Bravos weren't the, primary defending force. It was that other unit. Unfortunately, they were poisoned. However, Bradley's Bravos, he still had a battalion. So, Major Bradley, he still thinks that a battalion should have been enough to get the job done. Though, it's not that he didn't have enough guys. It's just that, they got completely shredded by the Genyosha, right? They're just too good, dude. Like, they're elite.
I mean, they were handpicked.
Yeah.
They've handpicked some of the best of the best.
Yeah, unstoppable.
So, yeah.
They're unstoppable.
Yeah.
Also, they saw Yorinaga himself out there in his Warhammer. He was out there. They saw him.
Tommy Eving talks about the account with the Warhammer and says he couldn't get a lock.
He couldn't get a lock, right?
Yep. The Phantom Mech. It's back.
The Phantom Mech, right? Yeah, both men admit that they had guns on Yorinaga, but they couldn't get a lock, dude. Also, I wanted to point out that it was Yorinaga who, quote, got the dock, according to Tommy. He got the dock. Does that mean that he shot Dr. Banzai? I think Yorinaga shot Dr. Banzai, dude. I think that's what Tommy said. So that's heartbreaking. Yeah, Yorinaga was out there, couldn't get a lock on him. Tommy's never seen anything like it, right? I never seen nothing like it. But Scott Bradley has, right? Scott has, remember? Back on Mallory's World, back in 16, remember?
Yeah, from when he was talking with Morgan at the wedding, he was one of the members who was told to leave the Kellhounds after Mallory's World.
Yeah.
And then that's why he was apologizing, is that he hadn't come back.
He was there, dude. I was there. I've seen him before. So these two guys, they just kind of sit silently in the cold for a moment before Scott asks Tommy about Dr. Banzai's condition, right? How's the doctor doing? And apparently he's stable, but he's lost a lot of blood. Oh, however, I did like this part. Dr. Banzai must be well-liked because it says that there were a lot of volunteers when the call went out for blood donors. Isn't that nice?
Apparently, everyone in all of the friendly units was more or less unanimously was like, we'll give Dr. Banzai blood.
Everyone loves Dr. Banzai. This guy rules.
Lots of Hatchetmen fans.
Yeah.
I'd be in that line for Dr. Banzai.
Yeah. So... Right. And remember, they're looking out. They can see the assembled Combine forces out there. Scott does wonder if the Fifth Sword is going to wait for the Genyosha to rejoin them. He notices the Genyosha isn't there, before they finally assault their position and kill them all, ostensibly. But Tommy doesn't think so. Tommy doesn't think that the Genyosha will be rejoining them, because Turns out if you spend any time monitoring their radio signals, you would notice that the Genyosha and the Sword of Light don't like each other very much. Right? Even we can tell that from their radio.
Yeah.
They hate each other, and everyone knows it. Now, Tommy tells Scott about how, while the Genyosha were here, Morgan took the hounds and sacked their base on Nashira. So that's nice. Scott wishes he could have been there, right? Get him for me, Morgan, you know? Right? He says something like that. Serves him right. Way to go. Wish I could have been there. But he wasn't. He was here, getting crushed, unfortunately. Tommy tells Scott that he'll use his unit, the Hong Kong Cavaliers, and they will...
It really rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. They will defend against the Sword of Light when they come tomorrow, right? We'll hold them off and hopefully giving everyone else time to escape.
It seems like the Hong Kong Cavaliers know a little something about honor.
Yeah. They're trying to get the Doc to safety. That's what he says. Give you enough time to get the Doc to safety through the Northern Passes. However, Scott refuses because Team Banzai has already given enough, right? You're the only reason that we've even survived thus far, right? Basically, he's like, nah, man, you know, you're done. And it's too late because he's already made the arrangements anyway. They've already loaded the Infernos, right? That's what he says. He's like, nah, dude, we've already loaded the Infernos. And I'm like, yes. Yes, dude.
We haven't heard from Inferno launchers here in a while.
It's our once a book Inferno check-in.
Trail one.
Yep.
Yes, dude. He's like, dude, we've stacked them up, dude. Every SRM tube, dude, we got Infernos in them. He figures they might as well cook a few snakes on their way out, so long as Tommy can take the wounded Bravos with him, right? You guys go on without me. We'll stay here and cook them, but can you take my boys with you? Tommy's like, yeah, man. So that's the plan, okay? However, this is where some guy comes running up, carrying like a radio transceiver, and he's like, y'all gotta hear this, right? And because
they really do.
Yeah. Apparently there are multiple drop ships incoming, and Banzai Base is on the line with them trying to figure out who they are. So they're like listening in to this radio transmission. The dude at Banzai Base is trying to get the incoming ships to identify themselves. But the lady on the other end, she kind of like dodges the question or what?
She is not being cooperative at all.
She
answers all of his questions with another question.
Yeah. She just wants to know what Combine forces are currently on planet, right? And Rawhide, we learned this is Rawhide. Rawhide tells her that we got the 5th Sword of Light, 36th, Deron regulars. And she seems disappointed though, right? She's got a real like it'll have to do for now kind of an attitude about it.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, the whole time we can hear some kind of weird squealing noise or something like coming over the signal from her end. You're like, what is that sound? Right? Something in the mix. It's hard to hear you. It's kind of screeching.
The whole conversation is pretty humorous, right?
They think it's humorous too, right? But Scott and Tommy and the dude, they're up there like laughing. It says that while they're like listening in, they're like chuckling because it is.
Because they're like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, who is this? Like, who are you? And she's like, who's all there? And they're like, I don't know, Sword of Light. And she's like, that's it? It is then that above, a dozen white sparks glow against the blue sky. Drop ships. Okay? We see them. And we hear Rawhide asks the woman on the radio if that's her, if she's with the new arrivals. And yes, she confirms our suspicions as the wailing intensifies. Okay? And Rawhide demands to know, though, again, who they are, and also, what's that noise?
Yeah. That noise is a beautiful thing.
And she tells him, we're the best of the best, Banzai Base. And those are the war pipes you're hearing.
That's right. The Northwind Highlanders are coming home. I get so excited every single time.
As soon as I finished that last line of this chapter, I was like, oh man. Brent has lost at this point. As soon, like, I could just imagine your first time reading this. and Northwind Highlanders get mentioned. And I know when you get excited how loud you are the warhorn for the Northwind Highlanders.
He goes running for the Utilikild.
Oh no, I don't have one of those. Just I not yet.
I'm gonna start rumors.
Not from lack of desire.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe I'll do a Northwind Highlander cosplay. We'll see. No, I just this scene is, well, it's bad. I love that it colors this whole conversation after the fact. You're like, oh, now you're like this woman. She's clearly got this, like, she's probably got a real thick Scottish accent, you know, and she's just like, oi, that's it.
Yeah.
All that I have to do.
Yeah.
And then there's just the screeching of bagpipes, like, and of course, like, they're kind of far off, so the radio isn't quite, it's like there's a lot of interference, so it's like hard to tell the bagpipes from the noise.
I don't know, sometimes it's hard to tell bagpipes from interference to begin with.
Oy. In case the readers and listeners haven't put it together, yes, the Northwind Highlanders are from the planet Northwind, and this is their ancestral home, and it appears the fox himself has made some kind of agreement, some sort of parlay, if you will, for employment. They were previously, if you guys recall, working for the Capellans, who had completely lost their damn mind. And so it probably wasn't the hardest choice they've ever made, with that nice juicy carrot on the stick being the entire world that is their ancestral homeland. So yeah, they're home. And I think they have some Cretans in their way.
Now, I did want to mention, notice they said after centuries in exile, okay, so they lost Northwind sometime in the past. And actually, in Shrapnel 15, in the newest Shrapnel, okay, No Dawn on the Horizon by David G. Martin is actually, it's cool. It's the story of them losing Northwind. It's awesome. Check it out. It's like the Highlanders. It's sad. It's sad, but yeah, No Dawn on the Horizon. Check it out. It's November 2841. So it's been, you know, since then, they haven't returned to Northwind since then. So it's been like hundreds of years, right? And now they're back, their ancestral homelands, right? This is what, and remember, this is what Romamna was mad about. These are the Highlanders that, all the Highlanders ran away. And I guess they're all, you know, they all come here.
But it apparently wasn't just because of the second Kearney getting real messed up. Apparently, there were some deals being made.
Yeah, foxed them. But yeah, that's it. The Highlanders are back, dude. It's awesome. We got Scott Bradley again. I thought that was cool. I'm like, yeah, dude, Scott Bradley. I love the little bit where it's like, oh man, Scott, remember back from the wedding? And it was like such a, you know, it was like so charming, right? We were like, oh, this is cute. Where he's like, I'm so sorry, Morgan. And now, you like the next time we see him, his unit is getting like torn apart by the Ginyosha.
He's like watching them from afar, yeah. on like a single fabricated crutch.
So shout outs to Scott Bradley.
So much goes on in this whole episode that we're covering, these couple chapters. Like, it really opens up, which I think after the wedding, we see the layout of the war. It feels like Stackpole was setting up the scenes, and here he gets right back into like throwing out, like, here's the next couple plot points for you. Yeah. We got the Ginyosha homeworld attack. We've got these divisions in the different houses. We've seen everything go down. And in this chapter specifically, we see that not everything is going perfectly for the Federated Sun units as well.
Right.
But having these two arcs back to back, where we have gone from Justin and his ideas for the Capellan side of the war, and then we cut over to Akira and see his side of the war, and we have seen Kurita and Liao both seem to be not taking the news of the war well. Right. They both seem to have gone a little off the deep end. But we still have these two outside of your planning ability factors, the X factors of the fourth succession were right now, paired up against it. They are the ones that are thinking clearly and trying to get a counter offensive going. And I feel like having both Akira and Justin back to back like that kind of sinks that in of like, here are these two unknown factors that will more than likely stir things up.
These sane individuals are the thin line keeping these two nation states from completely caving to the Fox.
Yeah.
It's funny because I see these chapters as, through my eyes, and I'm not a Fed Sons fanboy by any stretch of the imagination. Sorry, Derek. To me, these two chapters are perfect examples of why these two nation states are doing so poorly against them. And it's what I've said before, right? Like, while the highlights here are Akira Brahe and the Genyosha as a whole, as well as Justin, overall what we're seeing is, again, these two factions that are fighting each other within, yeah, just as much as they're fighting the Federated Sons. And I think until these individuals who are more wise than their peers are able to position themselves in a way like Justin is, where they can actually turn the tides, I think that both of these factions are going to continue to have a hard time against House Devion.
No, I agree. And I also think an important thing to keep in mind here is this war seems to be going exactly how Hans and his boys,
yeah,
saw this unfolding. That infighting feels like it was even planned on.
Totally.
Just by the offenses we've heard about, how strong the push into the Capellan space is, and how they haven't pushed on the Curetan border from the Draconis March as much, with the mercenary conundrum going down. He may have not planned for that exactly, but it seems like he had all of this set in motion, at least in a broad scheme, way ahead of time. And I love that in these last few chapters, we are getting that little peek into something of like, maybe things aren't going to go exactly the way he planned. Maybe there are some things he didn't foresee in these two characters.
Well, I've had these conversations with BattleTech fans, and there's a lot of people that are like, oh, the Federated Sons have plot armor. But I feel like there's no like, you know, I don't think Stackpole just hands Hans Davion the keys to the kingdoms here. I feel like we see why he's so successful throughout this. I feel like it's obvious to anyone that looks. It's not plot armor.
He's just better.
Well, he doesn't even have to be better. It's just that the majority of the Federated Sons are working together, and the ones that aren't, the forces in opposition to Hans Davion, he's got a plan to deal with. Hans has been able to be proactive here in it entirely, right?
Yeah.
Hans is controlling the tempo.
Yeah. You know what's funny about Northwind? You know who took Northwind from the Highlanders? House Davion. Then centuries later is like, oh, I got a little something for you.
Nay, look at this little,
yeah,
got a little tasty it. Treat.
That was ours.
But we'll have to see what else is in store for us in this fourth succession war. We come back next week when we finish up the second book of this trilogy, Warrior Riposte.
This was another episode of Mechs and Men. I am Kanan Hill, and I was joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent and Aaron. We would like to thank the author, Michael A. Stackpole, and, of course, all the other writers and artists who work so hard to keep BattleTech alive. We would like to thank Catalyst Game Labs for being such generous stewards of the property. We have an email, advice@heat.management. If you have any questions, corrections, suggestions, and we have a remembrance coming up soon. So please, advice@heat.management. We are also on social media, Twitter, Instagram, @ofmechsandmen.
You can also find us in the Valhalla Club Discord. You'll find a link in the description of this episode. It's probably the easiest place for you to find us and chat directly with us. And also, we try and join on Friday nights for a little MechWarrior Online with some of the other podcasters. So come check it out. We'd love to hear from you.
We will return next episode to complete our discussion of Warrior Riposte by Michael A. Stackpole. Until then.
Until next time.
Selah.